Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail, that, but in fact, it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome to episode 111 of the podcast, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you. Andrew, we, in this podcast, we're going to get to do something that we only get to do once every 10 years. Okay? You look confused. That's review a new Range Rover. I'm not talking I'm not talking about a derivative or a facelift, but a brand new Range Rover. That only happens once every 10 years. So, so we won't record a podcast like this for another decade. Imagine if we're still doing it then. So we are talking about the new Range Rover. Well, we'll see. We are talking about the new Range Rover. And you've driven it. You've been driving the new car. So we'll have a proper deep dive into what this new one is like to drive. But there's also been a lot going on in the world of cars this week. So before we get onto Range Rovers, we need to talk about a couple of other things. Should we start with the rather expensive Mercedes?
The quite expensive Mercedes, yes.
Perhaps underselling it a bit, because it's been confirmed now, hasn't it, that Mercedes has sold one of two Uhlenhaut coupes.
Correct.
Sold for £115 million, making it officially the world's most valuable car. Now, it
by
might
an enormous
be,
margin.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, well, it's more than doubled it, hasn't it? The official record.
Yeah.
It's possible that other cars are trading hands for more money privately in the shadows that we don't know about. But publicly and officially, £115 million is a record. We're not going to dwell on this. You have driven one. Is this the one you drove? Do you know?
No, this is the other one. So they're known as red and, they're known as red and blue because of the colour of their upholstery. I drove blue and it's red that has sold. I drove it... not that long ago, I can't remember, 5-6 years ago, at their test track in Stuttgart. One of the proudest moments of my career, I guess, because, you know, I think you can count on the fingers of one hand, without troubling your thumb, the number of people outside Mercedes-Benz who've driven that car. I couldn't believe it. It was every bit as amazing and extraordinary. It is, I think visually, I wouldn't say it's the most beautiful car, even though it is beautiful, but it is one of the most visually fascinating cars I've ever seen. The detailing on it, the way it just draws the eye, you know, I spent a very long time just looking at it. And I'm not the sort of person who spends an awful lot of time looking at cars because I just frankly much rather be driving them. And then to drive, it's basically a mid-50s Formula One car, because that's what the sports car was. It was a sports car version of the Formula One car they had, and this one, but in coupe form. And it was every bit as amazing and extraordinary, incredible as that sounds, and the privilege of that. And again, you know, no one said, oh, you know, you don't do more than, you know, 4,000 revs, don't go fast around corners, don't, you know, they just said, go and drive it. So I did. Absolutely amazing. How lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are very special cars, aren't they? They are road legal, and there are only two in existence. Mercedes had both. Now it clearly only has one. 300 SLR coupes is what they're probably known as. The question arose, why would Mercedes sell one of these cars? Why does it need the money? Somebody, just to put this into perspective, pointed out that the sale figure would just about or almost cover a year of Formula One, which is kind of extraordinary. But actually, there was an even better reason for selling it.
Yeah, if you think about the money, you think about the number, 115 million, I mean, it's so extraordinary. It's almost one of those numbers. It's like a bazillion, isn't it? If you actually think of, you know, £1 million and then you think of 115 of them, it is such an enormous amount of money, frankly, for anyone to pay for anything, but for a single car, it almost defies belief. But we are told, in fact, I've been told by someone who absolutely ought to know, and it is kind of there in a press release, but every single penny of that is going to go into financing. I mean, I think Mercedes is effectively going to finance educational programs around the world through this sort of foundation that they set up to encourage young people to study STEM subjects and to become, you know, the engineers that the world's going to need in the future. And it's, you know, I think it's quite easy to be cynical about this because, you know, manufacturers put out press releases about this and they always try to spin these things the right way. But actually, you know, if that's what all the money is going for, that's what all the money is going to. You know, they're not going to lie about that. So, you know, as far as I can see, you know, absolutely hats off to them, because I thought they were going to do it because, you know, developing electrical architectures for the next generation of EVs is so bloody expensive, and they got two of these things. They thought, well, actually, we could take a big chunk out of the budget for, you know, by getting rid of it. Not that at all. So from everything that I've seen and everything that I've heard, and I do know some people who are quite close to what's been going on, it's been, you know, they've done the right thing for the right reasons, and, you know, I can only applaud them for it.
Amazing car. And it's been sold for a brilliant reason as well. So actually, I think it's very commendable. Okay, well, that's the Uhlenhaut Coupe. Let's move it on. BMW M4 CSL. Now, recently on the podcast, we spoke about, there was a teaser image, wasn't there, that revealed nothing at all, except that there would be an M4 CSL part of BMW M's 50th anniversary celebrations. And we spoke about what the car might be and how it might be different to a GTS. There was the M4 GTS last time around, the M3 GTS before then. And we wondered if BMW was just reprising the CSL name because it's the 50th anniversary and it's an iconic badge, or was there a particular reason for using CSL and not GTS? Now, this line from the press release, I have to be honest, my heart sank when I read it. The new BMW M4 CSL has track driving as its raison d'etre. They built a track car. And you and I both said, didn't we, wouldn't it be lovely if they didn't build a track car, but instead built something a bit subtler, absolutely optimised for the road, to be enjoyable at road speeds, focusing more on lightweighting than on power and grip. And, well, they've done something different. That's not what they've decided to do at all. Another thing that demonstrates what BMW wants to do with this car is that they've quoted a Nürburgring time, 7 minutes 20. That's the fastest lap time ever for a series production BMW.
But it's still, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that they've decided to play the Nürburgring game, because I'm afraid, so it's an awful thing to say, but when I see a stripped out 2-seat high performance car like that, and I think Nürburgring lap time, you know, the first figure that comes into your head begins with a 6 now, doesn't it, these days? I mean, I know it's ridiculous, because 720 is a really, really fast time. But, you know, BMW must have known, particularly given the way they've chosen to price it, and the fact they're taking the rear seats out, that everyone's just going to compare it to a 911 GT3, aren't they? You know, they cost, you know, they're within, their price is within £3,000 of each other, and, you know, and they seem to have gone down exactly the same road with it, in terms of, you know, taking out the research, making the car lighter, and so on. But it's 20 seconds a lap slower. Cool. And why would, so I don't understand why you draw attention to that.
That's a good
point. You know, if you're going to play the Nürburgring game, you know, play it with the right cards, or just opt out of the game. So it's strange. It's curious. And that's despite the fact, and this is, I think, is probably as good an indicator as the kind of car that BMW has created as anything, despite the fact that it comes as standard on Cup 2 R's. Not Cup 2s, Cup 2 R's, which are, I'm sure, you know, everybody listening to this will know, are pretty much the most extreme road legal, street legal tyre you can get. And they're just designed, they're just grip generators, aren't they? They're just designed for, you know, they have a very sharp peak, and then they actually plateau and behave themselves for a while. But, you know, on that lap, when they're absolutely fresh, they give phenomenal levels of grip for a street legal tyre.
In the dry.
I mean, In the dry, yes. Best left parked when it's wet. are we going to run through some of the headlines?
Yeah, so let's do that now. I saw something interesting in the press release. BMW says CSL stands for Competition Sport Lightweight. Well, it used to be Coupe Sport Lightweight, didn't it? So that's changed. I wonder if that's because CS has actually been used on four-door cars, which are not coupes. I wonder if they've adjusted what the C stands for that reason. They've taken 100 kilograms out, no rear seats, carbon ceramic brakes, lighter wheels, carbon front seats, reduced sound insulation, part titanium exhaust. So it's 100 kilograms lighter than an M4 comp, but the EU figure is still 1,700 kilograms. So it's still a chunky thing. 40 more horsepower.
I mean, that's the thing, okay. I mean, I tend to... I mean, it doesn't really matter, I guess, whether you use EU or DIN or figures, so long as you're consistent above the board. I tend to use DIN figures, which I think are 70, 75 kilograms. I mean, but it's 1625, isn't it?
Yeah. DIN, yeah.
But, you know, CSL, in what way is a 1625 kilo car in any way light? It's not. It's lighter. And so maybe that's what it should be. You know, maybe that should be Competition Sports Lighter. But it's still not. It's still, you know, it's still not a light car, is it?
No.
And also, you know, 100 kilograms, you know, okay, it's 100 kilograms, but, you know, if you look at what they've done, it's, you know, clearly, you know, rear seats out, carbon seats in, ceramic brakes, that's the majority of it there. It's, you know, it's less than they took out the E46 CSL, both in terms of proportionally and also actually, I think, someone's going to come and tell me I'm wrong. I think the E46 was 110 kilos lighter than the standard M3 of that era. So, I don't know. I mean, I know that an awful lot of people are going to look at that Nürburgring lap time, look at the price, look at the fact that it's still got an 8-speed automatic gearbox in it.
Yeah.
Yeah?
An auto.
An auto. Not a DCT, an automatic gearbox. And they're going to think, well, you know, how seriously should we take that? I mean, all I would say to everybody who, and to be fair, we did tweet something about it when the news came out, and the response has not been positive. People, I think, funnily enough, focusing mainly on its appearance. We'll judge it when we drive it, won't we? That's all we can do, is we'll drive it and we'll tell you exactly what we think of it. Without fear or favour, and whether it is worthy of that badge. I think it's only the third time they've used it, isn't it?
It is. Third time. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, that you're making a promise there, aren't you? You know, and it's interesting that, you know, in the past it was a GTS, wasn't it? They kind of shied away from it. Mm. But this is them going, okay, we did it 50 years ago, we did it 20 years ago, and we're doing it again now. You know, watch out, guys, here we come. So you better deliver, seriously.
So they're building 1,000. 100 yep. will come to the UK at 129 grand each. That's a chunk. And so I've looked at the ways that it's different to an M4 GTS, or an M3 GTS for that matter. And it comes down to three things. The CSL's got no cage, it's got no rear wing, and it's got no manually adjustable suspension. So that's it. But otherwise, it's the same recipe. Weight loss, very sticky tyres, bit more power, yeah. no rear yeah. seats, very lightweight competition style front seats. It's, to be honest, it seems slavish to me. You know, they've said, we're going to do a CSL version, and it just appears to me like they've defaulted to the same stuff that they defaulted to when they did the GTSs. It's like there's no particular imagination. Let me give you my recipe for what an M4 CSL might have looked like. So there would be a strict weight loss program, like there has been, but take it as far as you can. It would have a manual gearbox. It would have no more power.
You'd save a stack of weight there, wouldn't you?
Stack of weight. It would have no more power. Maybe even it would have the lower power output of the non-competition model. It would have Pilot Sport 4S tyres, which on the road, in the dry, generate bundles of grip. But
they generate as much grip as an old cup as a old cup tyre that did.
Yeah.
So they're that good. Yeah. But they also work when it's wet, which means you can use the car more often. You can enjoy it more often.
Yeah. I'd have 19-inch wheels all round. The CSL has 20s on the rear. I'd have no cage and no wing, like the CSL, to be fair. But it would be tuned very specifically for the road. It would be supple. It would feel agile. It would be engaging and rewarding at moderate speeds. I wouldn't quote a Nürburgring lap time because that just defines the character of the car, actually. It's not what it's for. Yeah. And I think the market now is mature enough to appreciate a car like that, a subtler, sort of slightly more low-key approach. You know, you just need to see how other cars with manual gearboxes that are road-optimised, they're in demand now. And the fact of the matter is, they're only building 1,000. It's got a CSL badge on it. They're going to sell. They're going to go. If they'd gone down that route, they could have done a GTS later on. And they could have... And the curious thing is that it isn't as though the previous M4 GTS is is really sought after. Okay, it cost 120 grand new. 30 came to the UK, and you can pick one up now for 85.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But then we all gave it a massive kicking, didn't we?
It looks as though they've just done the same thing. I don't know. As you say, the proof is in the pudding. We'll wait until we drive it. And let's remember that the M5 CS is a stonking car that doesn't seem to make much sense on paper. Perhaps the M4 CSL will surprise us.
I mean, but clearly a lot, because I mean, let's not forget, it's £50,000. It's and I knew I'd find a way of getting it into this podcast, an Alpine A110 more expensive than an M4 comp. Yeah? That's a lot of money. And if you look at what that's buying you, in purely mechanical terms, that's not £50,000 there. So what you're buying is the exclusivity. That's why they can get away. That's why they think they can get away with charging that amount of money for it. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that at all. I think it's absolutely fair enough. But if you think it's going to be £50,000 worth better performing, again, we'll judge it when we see it. But my strong hunch is that you're going to be in for a bit for something of a disappointment. Then again, if you want, you know, and if you look at the values of E46, M3 CSLs. And let us not forget, that car did not escape without criticism at the time. You know, lots of us, me included, piled in about the SMG gearbox, which, and people get upset with me, one in particular, I don't know if I say this, but still compromises the car. But, you know, that hasn't stopped that car becoming an extremely valuable car. And the original CSL, the Batmobile from 1972 or whenever it was, I mean, they are, you know, truly valuable motor cars. So, you know, maybe that badge has a magic to it. Maybe, or maybe, and I absolutely don't rule this out, that BMW has found a sweet spot. They've done to this what they did to the M5 CS, and it's not going to be like the GTS, which was a truculent, difficult, to me, just unpleasant car to drive. I can remember driving an M4 GTS, and I think it might have even just been a standard M2, because I'm not sure the comp was out there, but whatever it was, on road, on track up in North Wales, and just so preferring the M2. So, you know, maybe they think, okay, well, the GTS, maybe that went a bit far, and maybe they have tuned it so that it does have, you know, good roadability, but why would you put it on Cup 2Rs as standard, though? I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it?
Because they're chasing that Nürburgring lap time. It's as though they can't help themselves. But,
They're so far away from, you know, a Nürburgring lap time, which is going to get anyone's interest these days. You know, when you've got a standard GT3, not a GT2 RS or even a GT3 RS, but a standard GT3 going sub-7, who's going to get excited about, you know, a car built around the same sort of philosophical means, costing the same amount of money, going 20 seconds slower? Even if you are one of those sort of Nürburgring, you know, lap time addicts and junkies, which I'm not, absolutely. It just seems a strange way to go. So it makes it all the more interesting, because I'm actually more interested in this car than I was before, because from the formula, I don't quite see where they've gone with it, which means we'll find out when we drive it, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to me like they haven't been able to resist all the usual temptations, and they've just ticked a load of boxes. Rather than really thinking, how can we make this special? But as you say, we'll find out when we drive it. Okay, let's move on Range Rover then. So I think we should rattle through a little bit of history on the Range Rover, just to give this new car context. So it was in the late 60s that engineers Gordon Bashford and Charles Spencer King,
CSK,
were wondering what to do, wondering what a bigger alternative to the Land Rover might look like. And so the first Range Rover prototype was built in 1967 and the design finalised in 1969. There was a curious story, wasn't there? Because 26 Villar-badged engineering development cars were built between 69 and 70. And they actually... What was the purpose of this? To throw the press off? They registered Villar as a company in its own right and badged the cars Villar in the hope that people wouldn't actually know what these things were as they were running around the roads. Disguised.
Are you looking for me to sometime in response to this? I have absolutely no idea.
Well, that is what happened. The car was launched in 1970, and it remained in production for 25 years, that original one, which is just bananas.
It is one of those cars, isn't it? I'm a sort of... I love looking at cars which have the reputation for being... the absolute first that created the class that they're in. And in almost every single case, it's not true. The Golf GTI was not the first hot hatch. The original Land Rover was not the first 4x4. The Renault Espace was not the first MPV. And the Range Rover was not the first luxury SUV. That was a thing called the Jeep Wagoneer. Jeep Grand Wagoneer, actually, which beat it by at least 2 or 3 years. But I think it can still be regarded, can't it, as the father of the luxury SUV, and not just the Range Rovers of today that I've just been driving, but, you know, everybody else who's got a big, posh luxury SUV. That's where it started. That's where that idea of being able to have your cake and eat it, having a car which you can tow your horse box around with, will get you across anything from a muddy field to the Darien Gap, frankly, and yet still retain sufficient comfort and refinement to be a truly, not just a usable everyday car, but a desirable car to use every day. It's amazing it took that long to happen, really. But, you know, back then, I mean, there were limitations, weren't there? You know, that Range Rover of 1970, it still had a ladder chassis. It still had live axles at both ends. You know, and that kept going because it was believed that that's what you had to have that off-road ability. And you know, even the Discovery, even the first generations, first two generations of Discoveries had live axles at both ends, and they are very, very limiting in terms of what you can achieve with ride comfort and everything else. So I expect that's why it took until 1970 for someone to really have that idea and pursue it. But you mean that first generation, absolutely. A wonderful car. And I think it's one of those cars, and I'm not sure people even realized how great it was at the time, because I'm sadly old enough to kind of remember it. And Range Rovers were, you know, they were quite cool things to have, to have. And, you know, I can remember when they when the 3.5 V8 became the 3.9 V8 and the two-door shell became the four-door shell, and they got ABS and various other modifications. Then right at the end, they did that, the LSE, the long one on the air springs with the 4.2 litre V8 and everything else. And, you know, and we admired its longevity and the fact that it was still selling and everything else. But I think now, looking back at it, I think it's one of those cars that is kind of acquired greatness after its death. I think it's a car that history has been kinder to than we were at the time. Not that anybody was unkind to it at the time. We just thought it was, you know, a quite cool, quite competitive product. And, you know, we liked it. It was out there, and we put its longevity down to the fact there was nothing else like that out there. I think it's only now that we look back on it and realize actually it was a landmark. It was an absolute landmark. And we look at all the stuff that's come off the back of it for both for Land Rover and everybody else who's piled onto the bandwagon ever since. And we can see that in the history of the car, you know, its line is a very significant entry, isn't it?
Indeed. I just want to dive a little bit into this luxury SUV thing, because certainly in the very early years, I mean, it was upmarket compared to a Land Rover, which was not difficult. But actually, it was still a comparatively utilitarian thing. So it had vinyl seats, plastic dashboards. And things like power steering, carpets, aircon, cloth or leather upholstery, wood. That stuff only came later on.
Yeah.
So it's as though this luxury 4x4 concept sort of evolved over those early years.
Yeah, but what it did have... you know, if you think of the Land Rovers that they're producing back then, they were extremely robust. They were leaf sprung and very, very stiff.
Yeah.
And the Range Rover had this completely different philosophy. It was coil sprung and had very long travel suspension. And so it would just kind of glide over everything. And that gave it a, not, don't like this word, but nevertheless, a plushness to the way it went from place to place that no Land Rover could ever hope to have. And it gave it that kind of veneer of luxury. And I think it's very interesting, isn't it? Because it didn't really start out at the kind of car that we now recall it to be. But you could see that they were thinking about it. And I think they suddenly realized they had something and then thought, well, now we're going to see how far we can go in that direction. And so they started doing things like putting power steering on it, making an automatic gearbox an option and that sort of thing. But I would say, even so, that if you take early 70s Range Rover and compare it to an early 70s Land Rover, I mean, the Range Rover is over halfway to an S-Class.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Than it is to... Yeah, it's closer to an S-Class than a Land Rover, even then.
So it wasn't replaced by the second generation model, the P38A, until the mid-90s.
Yeah. Can I say that? Can I say something about that?
Go on.
Because I mean, I was a motoring journalist there, and I was on Autocar when it was replaced.
Yeah.
And we got that car so wrong.
Oh.
I didn't, because I happened not to be involved in it. I'm sounding smug, I guess, but I don't mean to. It was a poor car. It really was. It didn't advance the art particularly. It was poorly built, not that reliable, not good looking at all to me. And, you know, coming on the back of such an amazing machine. And yet at Autocar, we praised it to the heavens. And I've always just felt a bit uncomfortable about that. You know, it was, I'm sure, the honest view of whoever it was who did the test. And, you know, and that's absolutely fine. But when I look back over all the things, Autocar got 98% of stuff right. It still does. And its hit rate is probably better than anybody else's, but we absolutely didn't get that one right.
Interesting. It ties into what we were talking about last week, doesn't it?
How many years was the P38 in production for? Compared
only
to
six
years compared to 27. Well, there you go. That tells you what you need to know, doesn't it?
So yeah, in 2001, it was replaced by the third generation model, the L322.
That was absolutely extraordinary.
Much more modern design, it really moved up market then as well, didn't it?
That car actually set the template for the Range Rover today. I can remember Land Rover at the time belonged to a thing called the Premier Automotive Group, which was run by a bloke called Wolfgang Reitzler, an amazing, charismatic German businessman. And I can remember going to the launch, which I think was in some sort of posh East London warehouse or something. And he came up on stage and started to talk about this thing. They spent £1 billion developing this thing.
And more than 20 years
ago. It was, you know, back then. And, you know, go and look at one. I can remember looking at the interior of it. And they had, the way they used the wood in the interior, it was almost like the wood was structural. It was like you had tree trunks growing through the middle of the car. It was so cleverly done. The car was beautiful. It was incredibly well engineered. It was everything the P38A wasn't. It was, in 2001, I think every bit as significant of an event in the history of the Range Rover as the original had been in 1970. That was the replacement for the original Range Rover, not the really very disappointing stopgap that, you know, that came between them. That was fabulous thing. It drove beautifully. You just felt proud to be in. I mean, I see them today because there's still lots and loads of them knocking about. And every time I see one, I just think that's a really cool car.
Mm. I was bowled over by them as a kid when they were new. Yeah. I just thought, that's it. I'd have one of those and some sort of sports car and I'd be very happy. That hung around for just over a decade. And we saw the fourth generation Range Rover, the L405, in September 2012 at the Paris Motor Show. All aluminium, so it's lighter than the previous one. Land Rover claimed, didn't they, that it was up to 400 kilos lighter, depending on the model. And I think lots of us reported that. But actually, when you weigh them, not so much. It probably lighter, like for like. But actually, this is a good time because our mate Stuart Gallagher posted a photo of Dean Smith's Range Rover L405 on the scales at 2.7 tonnes.
Yes.
He said 40 kilograms of camera equipment, half a tank of fuel, but 2,700 kilograms.
Yeah, but that's what you know, a Disco 4 weighs, or a Disco 3.
You know, they're all chunky,
around
the
2.6, 2.7, 2.8 mark. Yeah, it's a lot of car.
Load one up with people and stuff, and that's 3 tons on the road.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Absolutely. You don't get an HGV license. But they're brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, I took one up to Scotland last year and went sort of roaming around. And they have that. Obviously, when you're sort of up there in the middle of absolutely nowhere and it's blowing a gale and the rain's coming in horizontally and you're on these itty-bitty roads, and if anything comes the other way, you've basically got to drive into a field to let them pass and everything. I mean, they just work so well because you're sat in there, you're warm, you're cocooned, you're comfortable. You kind of feel immune to the forces of the outside world. And that is, I think, increasingly what a Range Rover should be. And I can remember driving that, knowing that the new one was coming, and thinking to myself, does this car feel in need of replacement? Not really. And that's surely the mark of a great car, isn't it? That it can be in production for, but it was in its 10th year of production back then, and still feel absolutely competitive a decade down the tracks. And it did. It was a really, really good car.
It is amazing. You wrote something beautiful, actually, about that previous model, the one that's just been replaced. You said that stepping into a Range Rover, particularly on this foul, you know, when the weather's foul and you're perhaps in a bad mood, you step into a Range Rover, it is like when you've been on holiday in some developing world country, travelling around for a week or two on rickety local transport.
Yeah.
And that has a charm of its own, but at some point it wears thin, doesn't it? And stepping into a Range Rover was like then pulling up to a dusty airfield to see a British Airways 747 waiting for you and feeling like you are already home.
Yeah, that's it.
Perfect.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, there aren't any British Airways 747s anymore, but the point stands, isn't it? I can totally understand that feeling of being safe and comfortable long before you get home.
Yeah.
Which brings
us on,
I suppose.
And that's a very special magic, isn't it? Yeah, so it brings us on to the new one.
Yeah, the L460, yeah. A decade later.
Yeah.
Evolutionary design, really, similar construction. And before we actually get on to what it's like to drive, I just want to cover this off again because it's very pertinent. 2 points, actually. We have discussed this before, but I will just go through it again. The Range Rover is a freak. In the marketplace, it's a freak, okay? There is no other car that sells for £100,000 plus, and even the previous one, once it had been specced up, the average was much more than £100,000. No other car that sells for that price moves anything like as many units. At its peak in 2015, 60,000 Range Rovers were sold in 2015, 1 year. That's £6 billion in revenue in a year. You see how crucial the car is to JLR.
It's quite good, isn't it? Yeah.
So nothing that sells for more than 100 grand gets close to those volumes. It is also the case that for a long time, the Range Rover more or less had that market to itself, that super luxury off-roader thing to itself. Not true anymore, yeah. Is it? Everyone
no.
else with an upmarket badge has leapt
Everyone's
on that bandwagon.
Piled in. Yeah.
But is that going to do any harm to the Range Rover's sales figures? I don't know. It doesn't seem to be.
I don't think it will because I think they've expanded the size of the market. And I think you'll find that, you know, people tend to be, instead of not buying Range Rovers, to buy a rival big SUV, what they're actually doing is they're not buying big saloons instead and getting in them. So I think the size of the market has got. So it's interesting what you're saying about the transaction price of the previous model, which was just over £100,000. Do you know what the expected average transaction price of the new one's going to be?
150?
125.
Oh, okay. Right, okay. So that's a decent jump.
Yeah. So it's a decent. So now most people will spend 120. And, you know, I can remember times when, what did they do? They did was it when they did the extended wheelbase version of the previous one? Well, the first one to, whatever the first Range Rover was to breach six figures, which was a fully loaded autobiography. And they were really nervous about that because, I mean, that's a big glass ceiling. And they didn't know whether the Range Rover brand was strong enough to command a £100,000 price tag.
Yeah.
And now the average is going to be 125. Onwards and upwards, eh? I mean, and as you say, the volumes, I mean, the revenues. I mean, and thank goodness for that because, you know, in other ways, you know, JLR as a company, you know, Jaguar is effectively a moribund brand at the moment. It's not doing anything at all and won't do anything of any significance until 2025. So that's like this huge land anchor that Land Rover has to drag around behind it. And, you know, they have nothing like. I mean, I've always said that JLR is absolutely the wrong size for a car company to be because it's not sort of small and boutique-y and, you know, and terribly exclusive. And they're not selling millions either, so they have the vast economies of scales. It is absolutely, in my view, the wrong size for a car company to be. But then again, if you can sell 60,000 Range Rovers for, you know, 125 grand each.
You're doing okay, aren't you? Wowzers.
Thank goodness for the Range Rover.
So I haven't driven it. I was supposed to go on the launch in California. But we got to Heathrow, got on the plane, taxied for 10 minutes, stopped. Pilot said, yeah, we're not going anywhere. Back to the terminal.
Oh, I didn't realise you'd actually got on the plane.
We got on the plane and it moved. It was almost on the runway.
What happened? Did it go tech on you?
It went tech. It's something to do with an air conditioning compressor. There is a backup, so there is redundancy built in. But the pilot said, I'm not prepared to fly without a backup, which is the right thing to do. He said, there was a lovely expression. It's better to be in aviation. It's better to be on the ground, wishing you were in the air, than in the air, wishing you were on the ground.
You were on the ground.
Yeah,
just so, a bit.
When he said that, I thought, okay, well, I'm quite happy to be getting off this thing. Yeah. So after hanging around at Heathrow for 30 hours, I decided, I'm just going to go home then. So I missed that launch, but
okay,
never mind, because you've driven it in the UK. Which is better,
yeah, I didn't drive in California. No. I drove it in Gloucestershire.
Oh, there you go. It's nice when the car launches in the county you live in, isn't it?
Yeah, and a bit of Monmouthshire as well. I drove it. The route came within, I'm not joking, I might have popped home to put another load of washing on, actually. the route came within 3/4 of a mile of my front door.
Bloody hell.
So, fantastic. Yeah, so I wish I'd known that at the time. I would have planned that. But anyway, so they only had D350s there. So we know, don't we, that there's a petrol version which has a BMW V8 in it. There's a plug-in hybrid which is coming later in the year. There's a low-powered diesel D300, but the only ones they had were D350s, and they didn't have any long wheelbase cars, so they didn't have any 7-seat cars. So I have driven one example. Now, that example happens to be the one that will sell most in the UK. And I don't mean it to be damning with faint praise, but it is exactly what I thought it would be. It is, they have taken the Porsche 911 approach to it. It is, to a previous Range Rover, what a 992 is to a 991. It is entirely evolutionary, both visually, and it is genuinely better at basically everything. What it is not is what the Range Rover was in 1970, or indeed what it was again in 2001. It is not a, oh my God, this has just completely reset the standards by which all these cars are going to be judged. It is a really good, thorough, modern, comprehensive reiteration of Range Rover values. It's a really good car, but it is not a landmark in the way that those two previous ones I mentioned are. It is the best Range Rover. There's people who say it's the best Range Rover there's ever been. Well, of course it is. And if it wasn't, can you imagine if it wasn't? I never understand why people say it's the best whatever when they're talking about an all-new car where they've had, you know, 10 years of technological advance in which to make it better. Yeah, fine. But is it fully competitive against its competitor set today? Absolutely. Absolutely it is. You know, I haven't driven it against what's it closest compared to be? I saw something like a Bentayga, I suppose. But it has... I did do quite a lot of reasonably serious... We went to Eastern Castle, where Land Rover develop all their cars for, you know, off-roading, and we went around some of the woods and forests there, and it was quite interesting. We went through some of the quite tricky stuff, but none of the stuff that I'd gone through a few weeks earlier with the intercooler Defender, which is really bloody hardcore. Nevertheless, it was enough to show that this is a highly capable off-roader, you know, and, you know, it's still got a low-range transfer box in it, and all the widgets and gadgets and stuff that you need to help you in that environment, full, you know, surround camera systems, wading depth, inclinometers, everything that you could ever want to help, and all the different driving modes. And out on the road, it's a lovely thing to be in. It is quiet, it's comfortable. I mean, it sounds boring because I wish I could say there was a wow moment. There wasn't. There wasn't a single wow moment. It was a big, long moment of deep contentment. Actually, Dan, you know what that car's like to drive, because if you imagine what you think a 2022 Range Rover would be like, given your extensive knowledge of the predecessor, that is exactly what it is like. It is exactly what you'd hope it would be, but it is not in any way beyond your wildest dreams. It's a very predictable car, in exactly the same way that a 992 is over a 991. And I'm not really sure I can add an awful lot to it than that. It's a really, really good car. But I don't think that in 100 years' time, when someone writes the history of the Range Rover, I don't think they're going to have it up there like they did with the original or the 2001 car. Whatever it is. 322, is it?
Yes. Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah. What about ride and refinement? Have they made good progress there, or is it... just a bit
better. They have. I mean, there was a bit of wind noise, and I think a few other people have commented on that. I happened to turn up there in an S-Class Mercedes, and in both terms of ride and refinement, it's not as good as S-Class Mercedes. But, you know, it, frankly, it never was going to be. You know, it has to, you know, they sit on tyres which are designed to go on an off-road. They've got a stack more frontal area. It's further off the ground. It's, you know, it's got a tougher job to do, and it does it really well. Is the ride and refinement good enough for that kind of car? Absolutely. Is it as good as it could possibly be? Absolutely not. I would say that the refinement is, it's difficult to say, isn't it, without having the old one, but I wouldn't say it was massively improved over the old one. I would say the ride is better. It does that thing that air spring cars do, is the ride gets better the faster you go. So if you're knocking along a country lane at 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, it rides really, really well. If you're picking it around town, it's a bit lumpy, but air sprung cars tend to be. What is really good about it, which I loved, is the four-wheel steering on it, because it's actually proper four-wheel steering. They say it's got something like the turning circle of a Focus or a Golf or something. And so when you are manoeuvring it around town, trying to park it and stuff, that actually makes it, the rear wheels turn by 7.5 degrees, which is a lot. It's a lot. And that really does make the car feel a lot more manageable. The interior is beautiful. Again, it's not groundbreaking, but it's really, I mean, I wish there were still a few sort of, you know, chunky physical things that you could, you know, just give that car the sense of heft, but it's not. It's a very clean, minimalist dash. And the new Pivi Pro Entertainment, as we've discussed, in reference to the Defender, I mean, it's been updated again. It's, the screen's bigger in the Range Rover, but that's, you know, it's fully competitive. It's not the best system that's out there, but it doesn't annoy the hell out of you like the previous system did. And yeah, it's a really nice thing to knock about in. Would I have that over an S-Class? I think it just depends on the user purpose. If I needed to tow anything, or if I was worried about, you know, getting cut off, or weather, or, you know, any of the reasons that anybody might want an SUV other than going, oh, look at me, I drive an SUV, then I think you probably would. I think in a pure dynamic assessment, I would say that, you know, an S-Class is still, you know, those sort of twin pillars of luxury car identity, ride and refinement. An S-Class is still better in both those regards, but it's not night and day. And the Range Rover is certainly more than good enough. So I really, really like the car, but I wasn't totally bowled over by it.
Interesting. Well, it sounds like they've done what they needed to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm looking forward to having a go. And we haven't even discussed the derivatives, the Evoque, the Velar, and of course we saw the new Sport very, very recently, didn't we? With much more differentiated looks to the Range Rover.
Same, I understand. Powertrains. I understand the response to the Sport's been amazing. They're very excited about that. Yeah, they're very excited about that.
Good. Well, there we go. Look forward to driving that as well. Well, we'll leave it there. That's the Range Rover. Yeah, special thing actually. Okay, so we will do the listener question in a moment. But I will just say thank you to JBR Capital for sponsoring the podcast. Well, there you go. If you're buying a Range Rover, maybe go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Please rate and review the podcast, and also subscribe or follow wherever you listen to or watch the podcast. That really helps. Ben McCarthy has got this week's listener question. Fairly long one. And it potentially ties into what we were talking about earlier. I was considering some of the comments made on the most recent pod, a recent pod, about sports cars becoming ever bigger and heavier. Acknowledging what Andrew and Dan said about car companies knowing their audience best and these heavier cars clearly not deterring people who actually pay the money, would one of the sports car makers, Porsche for instance, ever consider a new model, a 911 or if it's BMW an M3 or M4, with a reduced footprint, a slightly less power, and slightly less power than the current model? It would favour both their emissions issues and also make for more unique and better driving package. Would they ever do it?
Doubt it. Not a company like that. I mean, Porsche did it, you know, they used to do it, didn't they, with the old Club Sports, with the, you know, the 911, the 968 Club Sports. I mean, 968 Club Sport was actually cheaper than the standard car in the mid-90s. But it would be a very low volume car. It would probably never recover its development costs. So it would be a sort of slightly strange car to produce. I think it would probably do the brand some good. I think that people like you and I would write lovely things about it and say how amazing it would be. But, you know, we wrote all that stuff about the Alpine A110, which is, you know, doing exactly that sort of thing. And they've struggled to sell. So, you know, I'm afraid it's a lovely idea. There's nothing I'd like a company like BMW or Porsche to do more than that. I think it's exactly what I would like them to do. But as we said on this podcast so many times, you know, people like us, you know, Dan, me, and all of you guys listening to this, we don't think in the same way as the typical customers for those cars think. And there are far more of them than there are of us. And the manufacturers can't be blamed for doing what most of their customers want them to do. And it's not small, low-powered, smaller footprints, more environmentally conscious cars like that. It's, you know, it's more, you know, quantity over quality every time, sadly.
Yeah, I agree with you. It would be great if they did.
Come on, guys. But come on, Porsche, BMW, anyways, prove us wrong. Just do it.
I just can't see it happening. Well, no. There you go. Thank you, Ben, for sending in your question. Please get your questions in, because we love ending the podcast with a listener question. And we'll be back next week.
Look forward to it.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.